Hello and welcome to There's No Business Like, a podcast where friends and industry colleagues explore topics and interview leaders in our industry of professional theatrical touring.
Thank you all for joining us back here at There's No Business Like. I'm Josh Benson. I'm here with my friend Danielle.
Hi, it's Danielle Van Hook from the Alden in McLean, Virginia.
Brian.
Brian Zelmer from KU Presents in Kutztown, Pennsylvania.
Katie.
Hey there, it's Katie Miller with the Midland Center for the Arts in Midland, Michigan.
And Kevin Maynard.
Kevin Maynard, Quad City Arts, splitting the border between Iowa and Illinois.
Okay, so my question for everybody today focuses around yesteryear of malls full of Wet Seals and Forever 21, Hollister. You know, all of those are basically dead at this point. The malls are not populated anymore, and there are a ton of just empty malls around this country. If you had a chance to do something with one of those malls that has been abandoned, what would you do?
Okay, well, first, I would get an HGTV film TV contract, primarily based on this lady who has no idea how to use a hammer, just trying to, like, find friends that will help her carry debris out of an old mall. There wouldn't be, like, a beautiful shot at the end. It would just, like, probably be me falling down an escalator. But I think it would be fun.
I would watch every episode of that. Top of the charts.
I would turn my old abandoned mall into a community center, reclaim that land, and use all of that infrastructure to create spaces for business incubators, arts organizations, maybe a senior center that has activities, a walking track inside for seniors. There's actually so much you could do for community using the existing infrastructure. There's already restrooms. There's already kitchens. Like, there are so many different things that you could utilize that sort of space for. You could put a food bank in there, like community kitchens that folks could come in and take cooking classes. Like, there's a lot of different ways to reimagine that space that could benefit communities small and large. So if I had a bazillion dollars and could do what I want, that's probably what I would do.
I would just tear it down. Just bulldoze it and put up a Walmart. Bring in that tax dollars. No, I'm just kidding.
That's the take I'm keeping, but go ahead if you want to go again.
I think what I would like to see is, I guess, very similar to Katie's. I would actually like to see an art center. I would love to see affordable studio space for artists to be able to create. If this was in the Quad Cities, I would love to see a food hall in there. You know, the nice little homage back to mall food courts. But I love a good food hall because I can't ever decide what I want to eat. And that way I've got plenty of choices. What a good way for culinary incubators. Yeah, I think that's what I do.
My answer is not as community minded. In fact, it's quite the opposite, because this scenario is pretty unrealistic for us to have a gazillion dollars to do something with a mall. So I'm going to go and be selfish with it. I'm going to keep the movie theater a movie theater, because I love watching movies. I'm going to keep the food court and just turn it into, like, all my favorite foods. And then the rest of the mall is going to become a giant laser tag court, or whatever you call it.
I was going to say paintball. So I love this idea, Brian.
And see, mine is much more commercially driven. I would take an abandoned mall and turn the big anchor store areas into, like, basically a big amusement park. One being a full water park, one being an indoor amusement park with roller coasters that go out of the building and back in, and then turn all of the standard, like, stores into the actual hotel, keep the food court as a food court, but turn it into a big amusement park and hotel attraction would be my view, because that brings in tourism dollars into the community, but it also brings activity for the community and really makes a lot of money, which is the great part. Well, referenced in the interview today with Jim Lentz of TKO is how one of his first jobs was working with an agency that was based in an old mall that was repurposed as recording studios. So enjoy today's conversation with Jim Lentz.
Jim Lentz with TKO Booking Agency.
Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
So, let's go all the way back to start with. How did you get interested in the arts industry to begin with?
Okay, arts industry for me all started out with music. Been a music fan since I was a kid. And I had an older brother, 4 years older, and he was all about music. We shared a bedroom growing up, concert posters all over the place. Through high school, actually, and then started playing the drums in junior high. Played drums in the high school marching band. the symphonic band, and then had a rock band with some friends, all just for fun. Never, I don't ever recall wanting to be a musician professionally throughout my life. We were very into going to concerts, seeing shows.
And what kind of music was playing in your room back then?
Everything from Eagles, Billy Joel to AC/DC, Led Zeppelin. It was rock and roll. It was easy listening. Jazz was big in our household. So got a good exposure to a lot of different music. And then when I was in high school, we'd get out to go see bands regularly. Grew up in Chicago and had a group of friends. We had fake IDs to get into the bars to go see bands. We didn't care much about, we really didn't. We weren't going out to drink. We were like, oh, we're going to see this band, going to see that band. And one time met a girl there who had just graduated from Purdue University. And her first job is that she was doing at the time was working in a booking agency. Thought it was fascinating. We had some great conversation about it. She invited me over to her office. I'm a senior in high school. It's spring. And ended up getting a job, basically like an internish type of a job. I don't remember if I got paid. I think I lied to my parents and said I was getting paid, but I don't think I was getting paid. I think I was just showing up. Did a lot of got a lot of exposure with that. And in this building...
And that was fresh out of high school.
Still in high school.
Still in high school.
Still in high school.
And at an agency.
Yeah. And started there in April of my senior year. The guy who owned it bought an old retail department store in Hammond, Indiana, and divided it up. There were rehearsal spaces and offices in there. He also was affiliated with a recording studio that was just over the border. They're just over the border in Indiana. And another studio that was a recording studio that was just over the border in Illinois. And so for about 2 years was working there, went to college, University of Illinois, and started booking bands into high school dances and auditoriums and, you know, doing that type of stuff. Got involved with some festival work and buying for some festivals, selling to some festivals, and it just all kind of snowballed from there. Between the recording studio and the rehearsal places, got to meet an awful lot of musicians. And one band in particular that was just getting started was Survivor, was in using the recording studio for rehearsals and recording their demos. Eye of the Tiger took off for them while I was a college student, and we all stayed in touch. And while in college... started to promote some shows. It started out as a project for a research paper on buying media. And so we rented a hall, me and a couple of other students. And the other students, they weren't as committed to the concert business. They were writing a paper and buying media. So we put on a concert, bought some radio ads, bought some print ads, all got A's on our paper. We made some money. And I just continued doing that.
Making money and getting A's at the same time. That sounds like the perfect college experience.
Exactly. Better than bagging groceries.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And everything just kind of snowballed from there. And I was going to college the whole time thinking, hey, this is a fun job to make money, meet girls, see concerts. And when I'm done with school, I'll figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. So then that never changed.
Yeah.
So just kind of took it from there and grew from there.
So what happened? College finished. What was your next step and next move coming out of college?
Over the course of the college years, ended up meeting a comedian who was doing a lot of business in the NACA, the National Association of Campus Activities. And he was booking himself, representing himself. And he said, hey, I could use some help. So started booking him, and by making contacts with the colleges, I ended up just kind of on my own. So we kind of started out together with this comedian and got involved with the NACA and basically started to build a roster with a couple of friends who were musicians. We built a roster and started booking a roster of acts through the NACA and going to all of their fall regional conferences and their national, and that also just tended to snowball and built us up to be. And we were basically an award-winning agency. We won awards in certain regions for Agency of the Year, and we had a great time. We were all in our 20s. It was a fun time. Out of that, Brian O'Connell, who's now Vice President of Country Music at Live Nation, he started the agency with us, and a couple of other guys who are no longer in the business, but we both went in different ways.
Yeah.
So
you started with NACA and you started booking into colleges. At what point did you shift into you? I mean, your roster at TKO now is primarily rock and roll.
Yep.
At what point did you shift into the rock and roll portion?
Basically, what happened was when Survivor rode the wave to the top of the mountain, had a series of top 40 hits, and then they took a break. And when they got done with their break, we had a relationship. They said, hey, would you be interested in taking us on? Let's all work together collaboratively. I was buying for some festivals around town and got to know some guys at Paradise Artists. And we had a conversation about joining together for that project, which quickly turned into, basically, we merged our company in with Paradise Artists at that time. And Paradise Artists was an agency that had a lot of oldies acts. And that's really how I got involved with the arts and coming to the APAP conference and going to the regionals. Our real forefront was it was a lot of oldies bands. We also had Maynard Ferguson, a jazz trumpet player, and had a handful of other things that were more traditional to the performing arts centers. What was funny is that when I remember getting started in that, and we were first coming here, and the arts market was still a little bit more pure, and what I guess would refer to as a little more stuffy. And there were so many people who would walk past our booth and look and say, oh my gosh, we don't do any of this stuff. And we'd get enough that brought us back year after year. And I recall crossing the line where some of those same people were coming in and say, hey, guess what? I think we need your stuff because we need to sell tickets. This really is our demographic. We're doing more contemporary. And to them, contemporary was bands who were 30, 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Their heyday was 30, 40 years ago. So
your agency was one of the first agencies to really bring rock and roll to PACs.
Correct. There were a lot of other agencies that were involved that sold rock and roll, but they weren't necessarily concentrating on that here.
Right.
Correct. Yep.
And so how did that all like really come about as far as breaking into the PAC market with rock and roll?
You know what? I think it came down to exactly what it was when the folks started to come in and say, we need what you have, because the demand of the audiences were turning into, you know, people who were getting older. Those bands were playing festivals, and the age group and the category and the demographic of people who wanted to come see them would rather go to the theater and sit down in an air-conditioned theater or a comfortable theater, wherever, you know, whatever time of the year it is. But, you know, comfortable seats than standing in a field. And they had money to buy tickets. So,
and so with Survivor and then one of the other bands that you've worked with for a very, very long time is also Blue Oyster Cult.
Correct. Yep. Steve Shank and I work together. Steve Shank is their manager and has been with them since the 70s. And he is also an agent TKO, and we work together at Paradise Artists. Blue Oyster Cult, hard ticket selling band that that every year does their share of performing arts centers, and along with a lot of our other bands. I mean, like, you know, Mark Farner from Grand Funk Railroad, he's out there selling tickets. We have a new project, Yachtly Crew, that they're in there playing performing arts center, selling tickets. It's a lot about selling tickets, at least the stuff that we're selling right now. Can't say it's all about the art, but there is art to it. It's music, it's production, and it's artistic.
Yeah.
Just in a different way, not in the traditional sense of performing arts.
So what would you say is with Survivor, with Mark Farner, with Blue Oyster Cult, what's the key to maintaining that relationship and keeping them on your roster and associated for so long? Because you don't see a lot of that longevity with agencies in the same way that you've had with those groups.
Okay, well, now just to clarify, Survivor has gone through a variety of different changes over the course of their time, changes in management, changes in personnel. I still continue to, we don't represent Survivor right at this time, but Jim Peterick, who is the founding member, had left the band in the mid-90s, and he and I have continued together to this day. And he's now, he has his original band from his first band, the Ides of March, that's out touring and packaging. He's writing songs. He's lecturing. He wrote the book Songwriting for Dummies. We represent him for his lectures, pretty much everything he does. And he stays very active. But the longevity really comes through the relationships and concentration on working with people. I've always maintained working in kind of a mid-level agency style and prefer that. Paradise left Paradise Artist in the teens for a new opportunity with TKO. They were opening up a California office and we came to an agreement that I was going to head up and open up the California office for TKO that was based in New York. The idea was that we would eventually open up in Nashville. The pandemic pushed all that along. Andrew Good, friend, a principal at TKO, opened up the Nashville office just before the pandemic. And over the pandemic, we ended up closing our California office with personnel moving down, some moving down to Nashville, some moving into other fields, other businesses, other even ancillary jobs within our business. But you know what? Everybody stays in touch. Been fortunate enough to work with a lot of good people. So with the artists, the agents, and the managers, it's all the relationships, as a lot of people will say about everything with the business. You know what? Staying in touch, taking the good with the bad, climbing up to the top of the mountain at whatever level that artist is at, and you know, hanging on when there's slips down.
What would you say is the key to maintaining that relationship? Is it transparency? Is it trust? Is it?
Well, transparency leads to trust. So as long as everybody's honest and upfront, telling the truth, I think that gets anybody anywhere in any kind of job or position or relationship. So yeah, it's like, you know, being straight up on facts and figures and being able to be business partners. We really go into it with a lot of, again, it's the luxury of having a mid-level company with a manageable roster is that basically me personally look at it. When we sign an act, we're going into business with them. We're not just representing them to put ink on their page. We're going into business. How can we build the brand? How can we make this better than it was yesterday? How can tomorrow and next year and the year, the 5 years from now, how can this be better? So we play long ball with a lot of our artists with the idea that they're going to stay. We go in with the idea that this isn't just putting them on the roster for this year and let's see what happens. We become business partners with them. Technically, we're brand partners.
What do you feel like is the difference between the way that your agency approaches it as facilitating as a brand partner versus a more commercial agency that sees the opportunity to, hey, let's put them out this year and just see how it goes?
Well, I mean, you know what? I mean, very, you know, the most successful agencies, I think, take the same approach that we do. It's a good way to stay successful for all of us, no matter what size agency you're working with. I'd just say for myself, I have found it easier for me and more enjoyable to be in a smaller situation, manageable. When I say smaller, more like a mid-level versus hundreds of employees. You know, I haven't worked in the major agency world, but I know of it and I have lots of friends. But you know what, though, too? A lot of great people take the same attitude at all different size companies. So yeah. I don't think it's different. I'm just, you know, answering the question of this is how we approach it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who do that way and find success.
Yeah.
That's where the successful people are, I believe.
The groups obviously feel like you're deeply invested in them in that approach as well.
Correct.
You mentioned Yachtly Crew.
Yep.
They're one of the few things on your roster that isn't a named headline act.
Correct.
They have been wildly successful since they came on with you. Talk to me about, one, how you found them, and two, what that rise has been like and why you think it's been there for a group that isn't a headline act on a roster full of headliners.
Well, just to correct you, they are a headline act. They're a branded headline act that sells tickets.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the beginning of all of that was kind of funny. Got a call from a friend and a manager that we've done business with over the years, Andy Gould, who out in California at this point, this was pre-pandemic, 2018, when Andy calls up, and he's managed a lot of metal bands. Linkin Park was one of his big signatures and flagship artists that he had from the very beginning. He calls up and he says, hey, one of the girls in our office is going out and seeing this band Yachtly Crew all the time. She says everywhere she sees him, It's jam-packed, and they're playing at the Viper Room in L.A. Let's go see them. I told him I don't get involved with tribute bands. I'm sorry, I'm not interested. He goes, no, they're not really a tribute band. He goes, I think we should go see them. And I kind of fought a little bit. I said, no, it's not really. And then I talked with one of the guys in our office. He says, you should really just go. It's Andy. Let's see what it is.
He's got a little bit of credibility.
Yeah. I thought, well, if he's interested, let's go see what this is about. So I went down to see him, and they were in the middle of an 18-night run of sold-out shows at the Viper Room. And they're playing all yacht rock music in front of a crowd of 25 to 40-year-olds, singing every word to every song. And we were like, okay, wow, these guys have got it. But again, I don't know if I want to go down this road, but let's talk to the guys. And once we got into a conversation with them, their headspace was, this to us is an avenue. And we didn't set out to be a tribute band. This is what's happening. This is what people are coming out to see. We want to ultimately be a recording act. That's what got our interest. From that point forward, we collectively work together. The band are all hardworking individuals. There's a core leadership in the band that they're so focused on marketing and selling tickets, and but also producing like a spectacular show, full production show. They don't want to be a bar band. They avoided anything that's called tributes. If, you know, when they were first starting out and they were still playing more in the club world, if tribute night was on Thursday, we wanted to play Wednesday. So always avoided that to build into their brand. But at any rate, ultimately has turned into selling tickets in some markets, selling as much as 4,000 hard tickets and full-blown real ticket pricing. Averages in the 1,500 to 2,500 in many markets. And they tour nationwide, and it's a mix of some corporate, lots of special events, lots of outdoor theaters throughout the summer, and performing arts centers. So it's like, we basically call it a production show, because it is. They come in with full production, a set, and music. So it's not just a quote-unquote tribute band that's coming in. So it's all about the production and the marketing. There's three different marketing companies that are hired for that band as they go around and they tour.
Let me say, they showcased in 2022 at AIBA.
Correct. Yep.
I wasn't intentionally there for their showcase, but they followed a pretty big name whenever they were showcasing.
Right.
And they lit that room on fire. Like, from the moment they walked out on stage, there was an energy and there was a stage presence that engaged the entire room immediately.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like that's part of the key to their success. I mean, obviously they're focused and they have the marketing and they have the mindset, but they have got a performance presence and an energy that is unmatched,
right,
within that world.
Right. And you know what? They come in to every show. I think it was Van Halen who coined this phrase. Somebody from Van Halen says, we treat every show like we're playing Madison Square Garden, and that's how we got on our rise. And they have that kind of attitude. They say, we want to treat every show like it's the biggest show that we're doing. And they do. They successfully achieve that. And they come out and, like you say, light up a room, and they can walk into a market on the first time, because they also make sure they're the most marketed band coming into the room, mm-hmm. coming into the theater and the venue for the first time. Second time, forget about it. It's all over. Everybody's coming back to bring
friends.
The name
alone is there then. I'm assuming they're already getting a lot of return plays and.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like 2024 is a huge year. We almost have, it's going to be, every year has been bigger for them. And like right now we have a pretty full schedule for the whole year, and it's January. So
yeah. That's, in both talking with you and kind of paying attention to them since I saw them showcase there, you know, they're outselling the people's music that they're covering.
In some cases, yeah.
and that's mind blowing, mm-hmm. all on its own, and speaks a lot to their presence and their production and specifically to their marketing. An artist taking ownership of their marketing is so important right now.
Oh,
in the industry with social media and the presence on social media and the importance of social media to access to fill your house, that marketing point and that engagement point for the act is so incredibly important. And I think that's one of the incredibly successful things that they have going for them.
Absolutely. Every artist who does take control over their marketing is a step above others out there that you really have to. It's the modern day. Everyone likes access as far from a fan standpoint. The more information that they can get their hands on. And when I say access, it's the artist Instagram and their social media, and that gives the audience a feeling of access to the artist. In Yachtly Crew's case, too, the other side is just keep pushing up no matter how things go. I mentioned that they wanted to be a recording act, and they have achieved that. Right now, last year they signed a deal with Jimmy Buffett's Mailboat Records and had a release in the summer, and they have a couple of single releases scheduled for 2024. So that's going, but they didn't stop there. They just keep pushing that the envelope. So they're not, and no artist should do this. And successful artists go by, follow the same rule. When you're successful, okay, they hit that level, but they have to keep pushing. And there's no time to stop advertising or stop marketing yourself that, the world is going to take care of it. Yeah, maybe for a very small percentage, and that's in a whole different world. But in the level that we're talking about, in the Performing Arts Center business and the mid-level of the business, it has to happen all the time. I remember in an advertising class in college, the professor had said, he says, if you just had to advertise and let everybody know about your product, and then you could stop because they all know, McDonald's would have stopped advertising years ago. Mm-hmm. Perfect example.
Yeah.
And so using that model, I think, for all artists across the board.
And so how much, you have a lot of artists that have been around a long time on your roster. How much do you talk to them and work with them about modernizing their approach from a marketing standpoint? Because the days of headshot and a bio are gone. Like those are, that just, it doesn't work anymore. How much do you engage with the artists to talk to them about getting updated modern materials and content for marketing purposes?
You know what? A lot of it is, it's an ongoing process. And a lot of it is borne by the requests of the presenters. Different presenters take different approaches. They'll look for something different. It's always that. Like a couple of years ago, the big thing that started out is we need a shout out from the artist.
Yeah.
And then we have a lot of artists too who take that. It's like, I'm not going to go do an invitation. But what we should do is maybe let's create a customized commercial that's going to involve the show. And so people can see what they're buying tickets to, not just me saying, hey, come out and see us.
Yeah.
And so, artists will take that on themselves and, basically meet the demand of a purchaser. That's just one vague example. But you know what? It's like the purchaser demands and the presenter's demands and a lot of artist creativity who come up with a lot of unique and different ways to promote and be seen. And for their audience to know they're coming to town.
So it's very much a responsive model to what's being requested is we'll find a way to fulfill it in some way and get you something. It might not be exactly what you've asked for, but we want to get you there fully in response to what the promoter or presenter is asking for.
Always ongoing. Yeah. I mean, there's going to be things that artists are going to create. There's going to be things that they're going to follow through by a request. I think everybody has to work together, because if we're not selling tickets, none of us are going to have the business for next year.
Yeah.
So artist has to sell the tickets. Venue has to sell the tickets. We have to be right there and support each side. So we all have this going on next year.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And from my perspective as a presenter, content is king. Especially on the social media front, and having different types of content from a single artist to where I can drop something into a story, I can drop something into a reel, I can also have a horizontal post, but the vertical content has become something that's so important, because 98% of people are viewing the content on social media on their phones, which is a vertical format.
Yeah.
And if you're not putting it out towards that format, you're not maximizing the potential of what's in front of them.
Right, right. And you know what, like you said, doing all different kinds of ways, keeping engaged with the fans, and also attracting new fans. In the access that we talk about with that fans are looking for, now you see like artists with their Instagram with their cat, and yeah. their love of the outdoors or their hobbies and things like that, which also brings people in. All of a sudden now cat lovers are looking at this particular artist because they were on the cover of Cat Magazine or whatever, whatever it was, you know. So it's a, you know, it's again part of the access. It's not just a just a photo in a bio.
Yeah. How much do you see requests for things for artists to post things about a show on their own social media as well?
Well, it's that's an ongoing thing. Different people take different approaches. A lot of people go straight access. Let's get to know the artist. Feel like you have a relationship with the artist. And then there's the strictly just promoting shows. But obviously, for the successful people, are finding a nice mix and a balance for, you know, you're putting out shows. You know, there's your, you know, you're showing your hobbies, you're showing this, you're showing that, your relationship with the fans. That's another thing that's always good is the artist's relationship with fans and using that in their social media. And by the way, we're coming to town. So, you know, I mean, we can all see, you know, what's out there and can pinpoint and figure out who's finding success and who's creating success and who's really making it happen. You just can't back down at any level. It's an ongoing, constant thing. Just like you say, everybody's looking at it on their phone. There's so many distractions. So have to find a way where you can keep a balance of promoting yourself, promoting your music, promoting your shows, and not making anybody angry because you're overdoing it.
Yeah.
Quite a balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You obviously were very early in the field as far as getting rock music into PACs. What are you seeing as the current trend as far as rock music and PACs? Genre wise, is it still the same thing or is it shifting in some way?
You know what? I think it's just not just in PACs, but what would be considered classic rock at one time was, or the oldies was the 60s. Then it became classic rock of the 70s. Then it became, oh, let's do the 80s. And now it's shifting in the performing arts centers. Their audiences, which they need to start attracting, are, you know, grew up on the 90s and post 2000 music. So, so that rock music is playing the performing arts centers.
Yeah. And you've got quite a bit of that on your roster as well. That 90s, 2000s.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Blind Melon and Buck Cherry and those kinds of bands. Buck Cherry, not so much PAC world, but you know what? It's that's, you know, they're working acts selling tickets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, I've loved sitting here and talking to you about this. I love the insight and I think you're the first person who started with an agency in high school and has never walked away from that.
You might be surprised. I don't know. I share that story with some other agents and lots of us, you know, it's kind of been a lifetime, maybe not on the agency side,
right.
But
there were a lot of people that started promoting shows and started promoting local shows in high school, but were never involved with an agency in high school. That's the part that's crazy to me.
Great. Well, it was a lot of fun.
And it all happened through a fake ID and dropping into rock shows in Chicago, which is awesome.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, thanks for sitting down with me. Thanks for your time, Jim.
Thank you. Been fun.
Thank you, Josh, for bringing us this interview. I have been waiting for somebody to recognize that I forget exactly how he phrased it, but people that are starting to have money to go to performing arts centers would like to revisit tribute bands from the 90s and 2000s. We don't have enough Hanson cover bands. You know, we certainly don't have enough boy band cover bands. Like, where is the Boy George cover band? Like, but finally somebody sees us.
Yes.
But I appreciate that he recognizes that, you know, we're getting to an age that sometimes we want to sit down.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah, Josh, I've enjoyed hearing this perspective and diving a little bit more into commercial music and Jim's journey and his choice in particular to stay at the size of agency, kind of that he kept kind of referencing, kind of like middle-sized agency, because that's something that works for him. And he can do the kind of work that he wants to do in that size agency at that kind of level. And I really appreciate the intentional choice it seems that he has made to find his niche and stay there and develop those artists and develop that talent and develop that part of the industry versus really bouncing around or trying different things. Like, some we hear from a lot of people, they do a lot of things. It's also interesting to hear somebody make a really intentional choice like that for their career.
Yeah, I thought it was a different way to look at the shout out videos when he was talking about, yeah, we're not going to do that, but we'll do this. And I still get ticket sales from them. I don't know if any of you use them, but once in a while when they come in, I do see a bump. So, I mean, they do play a role sometimes, but I do prefer something a little more meaningful. I think, you know, I think it can help a longer lasting engagement. So I do like the idea of them not just saying no, but offering to do something that's a little bit more meaningful.
Yeah. Bouncing off that, Brian, I again, appreciate this in-depth conversation, Josh, about marketing and assets. And I think it's interesting that what they're producing in terms of collateral is really driven by presenter requests. And I think it harkens back to the conversation we had with Dina Blizzard about artists really taking responsibility and creating content. This is a slightly different spin on it, but I do think that dialogue back and forth is really important about where, what do presenters really need in this day and age, and how much we can ask of an artist, and how proactive artists can be to provide those things up front. So there doesn't need to be that dialogue back and forth. Same thing, our conversation with Bill Blagg about how Bill provides all of these things up front. So presenters have what they need from the get-go, and we don't have to spend a lot of time in that conversation back and forth. So clearly this is an ongoing conversation that kind of varies across the industry, but I appreciate that perspective and hearing what he and his artists are doing, willing to do to assist presenters with ticket sales, because he's right. Like, they want to sell tickets, we want to sell tickets, right? And we both had the same end goal. So continuing to work together and figure that out. I'm glad that we're moving really in that direction.
And he didn't say this explicitly, but I feel like I heard a reference to the difference between, like, quote unquote, mission-driven art and entertainment-driven art, in how, you know, he was talking about his first couple of years at APAP and then how that turned around. And, you know, it's a conversation that we've had before that, you know, I think is really important. And, you know, we need to remember that a balanced season has a little bit of everything, and that, like, sometimes getting the people in our building that haven't been there before is by doing some of things that you might feel like are more commercial driven. And, you know, there's space for everybody on the floor.
So for me, like, we do a ton of commercial stuff in our venue. We're very heavily commercial driven, and the community responds so well to that. But the beautiful thing about the commercial work is it gets people in the building, and they then discover other things that aren't as commercial. And the commercial stuff also allows us to do more of the cultural and arts-based work because of the money that the commercial work brings in. And it's that balance that really works for us.
And to be clear, I mean, you're actually, the stuff you're saying is less commercial or not commercial, they almost become commercial then in that way, the way they're being tied to these other shows, you know, for some of the audience that isn't used to them. And so it kind of just expands the full umbrella, because I actually don't like dividing the art. To me, art is art, and there's all different types. And I don't like it when we say the mission driven or the cult, you know, the commercial or whatever. To me, it's all mission driven if it's part of your mission. But anyway, I'm diverging. I agree. I've gone into that realm, Josh, just to contradict myself now, because I am adding some more quote unquote commercial things to my season. And I'm starting to see successes in that. And it is spilling over into my quote unquote artistic or cultural programming. I can't say we have, you know, success yet, but we're heading in the right direction.
Brian, I do see what you're saying about, you know, splitting up the work like that, because I try to refer to it as, you know, things with name recognition, mm-hmm. because it's just, you know, some things are more of a household name. They've been, you know, out there a bit longer. But there's also a lot of really great stuff that, you know, people may not be aware of, which is, you know, why we combine those things together to expose our community to those things.
I think it's crazy that Jim started working for an agency while he was in high school.
Yes. Yeah. And then he started a roster in college.
Yeah. A lot of people promote, you know, become a show promoter and, like, will promote the local bands in their community when they're in high school. But he was legit working with an agency at that age and starting to learn the actual business side of everything.
I also think it's really impressive that he stuck with it for, you know, since high school. I mean, because I can think of the things that I was doing in high school that, you know, I obviously am not doing now, but I mean, he's had a complete through line to stay in the industry like that.
Well, Jim, thank you for sitting down with us, and Pod Squad, thank you for being here and being a part of this conversation. Catch us later here on There's No Business Like.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to There's No Business Like. Our producers and hosts are Brian Zelmer, Josh Benson, Kevin Maynard, Katie Miller, and me, Danielle Van Hoek. Views expressed in this podcast are ours alone and are not reflective of the organizations we are a part of. Keep up with us at nobusinesslike.com. There you'll find links to all of our episodes and socials. If you like this podcast, give us a like, a follow, a review, or our favorite, a 5-star rating. Oh, wait, what was that site? I got it. Don't worry. It is nobusinesslike.com. Do I sound out bus I-ness every time I type it? Yep, sure do. Stay in touch, my friends.
By the way, for those curious, there are some places that still call it a camp shirt, but it is a plaid camp shirt. But most places just call it a plaid shirt.
Vindicated.
Like, I'm not wearing Ann Taylor.
It was like an Old Navy thing. And like anthropology and... not anthropology.
Don't throw anthropology in.
No. What was the Aeropostale? Sorry.
I'm not down with this.
Kevin seems more like a Banana Republic kind of guy.
Yeah.
But in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was a teenager thing.
No one called it a camp shirt.
Yes, they did.
I'm into the dress barn.
That's not surprising.
Katie, do you remember the fashion bug?
Yes.
I remember fashion
I was bug. Thinking about that the other day. And like, what just a bug. Disgraceful store.
Delia's.
Oh, well, that was fucking fabulous.
Forever 21. Oh, get me some.
I wasn't allowed.
Isn't that still around?
Or is it still here?
I wish they had a Forever 35 because I would just like.
Forever 35 is just camp shirts.
No. They're stylish cardigan sweaters and like nice dress pants for work.
No, it's like the back section of Old Navy.
Isn't that just like an Ann Taylor then?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Isn't that just
But cheaper. This is the thing, because I love me some Ann Taylor, but like I can't afford Ann Taylor. So that's why I have to do Ann Taylor Loft, because I can't afford regular Ann Taylor.
You ever been to the Loft Outlet? That's my price point. Okay.
I had to Google millennial stores when they were kids. I got Abercrombie & Fitch, Bath & Body Works, Forever 21, Aeropostale, Charlotte Russe, Hollister, Barnes & Noble, which is not a clothing store, whatever, Foot Locker, and Old Navy were the top ones.
Even as like a youngin, I hated Hollister because it was so loud in there.
It was so smelly.
I never went
to smell. And then you had that crate,
And then there's three alternatives, PacSun, Urban Outfitters, and Wet Seal.
Wet Seal.
I can honestly say I've only shopped in two of these stores.
Like Wet Seal walked so that Forever 21 could run. Do you want to know my favorite Forever 21 story?
Yes.
Like 2 years after I moved here, there was this like local news story, and it was like this guy was going into like different stores, but like it was like mostly Forever 21s and like one JCPenney, and he had like a box cutter knife and he was poking people in the butt and like not maiming them. They all were just like, huh, what? And then turned around and like saw a man with a box cutter running away, and it became national news. Just this guy being super creepy in Forever 21.
Box cutter booty poked.
And they were calling him the butt slasher. And my mom sent me a text that was like, you got to watch out at the mall.